Alrighty, what day is it today? Today's the 2nd, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, January 2nd. So we've been doing the politics of exclusion in Judaism for, you know, several months now. We've been dealing the Rambam's thought, particularly in his Laws of Repentance, his Hilchot Teshuvah, where he goes through, he lists a bunch of categories of people who don't get a share in the world to come. And then in the subsequent Halachot, he explains, in a little more detail, who are these types of people. Up until now, we've dealt with things that would come under the category of more theology. Not in the sense of what you believe, but we also made the distinction. It's not that these are thought crimes as much as you would actually have to say something and say it definitively. It's not Omer. You actually have to get up and say as a declarative statement, such and such is an actual fact. Not an issue of asking questions of how do you know. I mean, if it was an issue of how do you know X, Y, and Z, you'd also have to ban many religious books. Here, pass this one down. You know, who just will ask a question rhetorically? You know, that's fine. Versus actually making certain statements. To repeat for someone who just came in, you know, now we have this, you know, handy dandy recorder. The rules of the recording are as follows: if anyone wants something off the record, let me know. I will pause it, and we will, you know, question will be off the record, the answers will be off the record. If there ever gets to, you know, people feel really uncomfortable, they feel that they have to self-censor, you know, recorder goes away. That's the deal making with people. So this is just out of request for a lot of people who wanted, you know, audio recording of the shiur, not from people in the neighborhood even, but from people, you know, outside all over the world, really.
Cool.
What can I say? I do decent PR. So up until now, we've been dealing with things like, you know, HaOmer, like certain things about God, certain things about belief in the Torah. Last week we discussed it about biblical criticism, issues of, you know, authorship, you know, things like that, of, you know, making certain statements. Now, source number 4 that we have on page 2 is Rambam Hilchot Teshuvah, chapter 3, halacha 9. Again, translations are my own. I take responsibility for all of them.
Notice that these all come out of a chapter of repentance.
Mm-hmm.
Why was exclusion part of this?
So he gets to that, like, towards the end of the chapter, you know, in terms of, like, why, you know, why are all these things here? And he discusses a little bit at the beginning, but he'll also get through at the end that for all of these people, you know, even if they may not get Olam Haba, there's still room for Teshuvah, when you can repent, when you can't repent. Right? That's how it kind of fits in the, you know, general theme. Ira, could you read in the English source number 4, because I haven't been here in a while.
Two are considered rebels in Israel. One, a rebel for one sin. Two, a rebel against the entire Torah. A rebel against one sin is one who has strengthened himself to do one sin intentionally, and he habituates and publicizes this fact, even if the sin was one of the lighter ones, such as he intentionally wears shanmetz,
which is linen and wool together.
Okay. Or he surrounds the corner for one's field. And
we'll explain that in a bit, yeah.
It results as if a mitzvah was nullified. This is a rebel for one thing, and this is when he does so with the intention of angering God. A rebel against the entire Torah would be one who returns to the laws of the idolaters at a time when a decree was enacted, and he cleaves to them, and he says, what is the advantage to me to stick with Israel, since they are base and persecuted? I am better sticking with those who are stronger. This is a person who is a rebel against the entire Torah.
All right. So here, right now, right off the bat, we're, you know, sort of moving beyond someone who makes a declarative theological statement that, say, would deny God's providence, to how is a person actually behaving. If anyone picks up Menachem Kelder's Must Did You Believe Anything, one of his major points is that we don't really have ideological exclusion as much as it's what you think plus what you do. It's an interesting book. Recommend people read it, and anyone wants to discuss it, more than happy to do so. Menachem Kelner, Must Did You Believe Anything? We show a lot of books here, that, or at least the ones that I like. I find that they're very, you know, good contributions. They're readable and will make you think, whether or not you agree with them or disagree with certain points. You know, they'll raise enough good points that, you know, my opinion, are, you know, good to read. Obviously, Must Did You Believe anything? Must a Jew believe anything? Menachem Kellner. So here we have, you know, he puts it, Mumarim. There are two types of rebels, and the way he categorizes them, and these are the two types of rebels in particular, are the ones who lose a share in the world to come. Right? So the first one is a Mumar la'avera achat. You are mumar against one particular sin, as opposed to the entire Torah. And in the second one, it's mumar l'chol haTorah kula. Now you can ask right off the bat, you know, if you are a mumar for one sin, why would you want to make a distinction between a mumar l'chol haTorah kula? Right, so that's one question we're going to address. If you're going to say that you lose Olam Haba for being a rebel against one sin, why do you need to then say you lose Olam Haba for rebelling against the entire Torah? Because, you know, one sin is less than the entire Torah. Right? So why
do you... Easy to do tshuva and to return.
Well, maybe...
One sin.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know. I visualize this thing as not as a linear order, but as a kind of a tree.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he doesn't want to exclude the guy who just doesn't keep kosher for strange reason.
Okay.
So there's sort of two branches you can take off of that. One is doesn't keep kosher just what do you say? Afsalachas, is that the word?
No, we'll get to the distinction there. You're actually
Dafka, this. Dafka.
Lahakas.
Okay,
Lahakis, which means to anger. Yeah.
That's one path in which it's worse than just not keeping kosher. The other path is excluding yourself from the entire people.
Yeah, great distinction here. You know, when we talk about mumarim, it gets elaborated in Shulchan Aruch, that there are two types of people who sin. There's the mumar lahach'is, someone who does so to, lahach'is means to anger. To anger God, does it dafka out of spite. And there's the mumar l'te'avon, which means you do it because you have a yetzer hara. Te'avon is your desire. So, and as the way the Shulchan Aruch makes the distinction, if you are mumar l'te'avon, if you have a particular weakness, we consider you as, you know, a full Jew. Which just for whatever you have a weakness, we don't believe you. Example that, you know, gives in the context is kashrut. If someone himself doesn't keep kosher, you don't trust that person for kashrut, but you would trust that person for other mitzvot, if it's a mumar l'te'avon. But if it's a mumar l'hach'is, if he does so intentionally out of spite, distinction they're given is, you know, it's one thing if, say, you know, give an example, you like a McDonald's cheeseburger, right? So, like, you happen to like the taste of it, like, okay, you've got a yetzer hara for it, you go for that. That would be mumar l'te'avon. A mumar l'hach'is, what would it mean to really do so out of spite, is if you can accomplish the exact same thing permissibly, and you choose to do it prohibitively. Example, let's say non-kosher meat. Let's say you're in a supermarket. The kosher meat and the non-kosher meat are the exact same price, exact same quality, and you decide to go for the non-kosher meat over the kosher meat. Right? When you have the ability to do the, you know, follow the Torah and not follow the Torah, you know, all other things being equal, right? And you choose to not follow Torah, that would be a way for you to, you know, put you in the category of a mumar l'hach'is. Or as he puts it here, v'nit parnespa, as the Rambam put it. It's another thing, like, if you don't keep kosher and you sort of brag about it. Like, you know, here's...
V'nit parnespa.
I'm sorry, v'nit parnespa. About, yeah.
You said me.
Sorry, thank you. Sorry, thank you. Yes. I misspeak quite frequently. I guess that explains all my typos, too. Right? But it's also v'chorgal, right? It's you habituate yourself to it. Meaning, if you have a desire, right? It's one thing to say you give in to temptation once or twice, but there's another thing if you habituated yourself to do so on a regular basis, such that it becomes part of your character. If this is your approach to certain things in Judaism, or at least according to, again, Rambam's definition here, if you come under this, that would give you the designation of a mumar l'hach'is, because you actively took steps to not just give in to temptation, but you give in so often that this is just who you are at this point.
Yeah, the thing that occurs to me is a guy might be a Jew, and he is into scientific thinking, he becomes a secular humanist.
Mm-hmm.
Should he do that? And not, I wouldn't say it's out of spite. The guy is philosophical and he thinks, why buy into one of his systems? Why not keep it open? But according to the Rambam, he gets branded as a spiteful person.
And that's not fair to the guy, because the guy is not being spiteful. He's just being open-minded.
Well, it's easy. Yeah.
You know, you could sort of say the same thing about somebody who challenges political correctness. Why do we have a mesitza? Everything's fine about Orthodox Judaism except the mesitza. Separating men and women is sexist, and, you know, and so I really like this shul except for that.
Mm. We get that a lot here.
Yeah. But it's like, hello, this is Orthodox Judaism. If you want to categorize yourself as something else, then you're something else. God bless. Good for you.
Yeah.
Another question, though. It seems like the Mumar is a much kind of lighter category, because he's not saying any of it is invalid or untrue. He's just saying, I'm not going to do this.
Right, which is, well, I wouldn't say it's in a lighter category, because according to Rambam, you know, this is one of the categories he says, you lose your share in the world to come. So that's still pretty severe, but it's a different way of rebelling.
Also, but meaning there's no consequence in this earth, on this earth, except that you can't trust them for that particular mitzvah.
No, that's for a Mumar L'Teavon.
Right.
For a Mumar L'Hach'is, according to Shulchan Aruch, you lose credibility for everything.
Oh, alright.
Right, so, yeah, that's an important distinction there.
I haven't heard your answer to what I said, though.
Right, okay. So, there would be, I would say, two different things there. Like, let's say, you know, you're a humanist, but you actually, like, keep all the mitzvot. Right? You're still doing things. You don't tell anyone what your hashkafa is. Oh, I'll pass that down to the open chair. Alright, let's say you're a secular humanist. You don't necessarily believe in the mitzvot. You don't tell anyone what you believe, but you still come to shul. You still daven, you still keep all the mitzvot. You're just trying to deal with things on your own. Right? I'm not sure if that would necessarily be a problem according to the Rambam, because you haven't actually made any declarative statements. And, excuse me, you're still keeping the mitzvot. If you say that you don't keep the mitzvot because you don't believe in God, or at least you do it to representatives because you don't believe in God, it seems to be, in that case, almost a combination. And let's say you didn't keep kosher. If you didn't tell people why you weren't keeping kosher, it might not come under the same category. I mean, just okay, as a mumar lahachitz, so just you're not keeping kosher, could just be you're not making a big deal out of it. According to Rambam here, it seems that, you know, there's actually an implication of rebelling here. Shehichzik atzmo la'asota ta'avera b'zadon, where he seems to be doing so intentionally. If he's doing so intentionally because he, if he's doing so intentionally because he doesn't believe in it, he's still doing it intentionally, which would still put him under this category, whether or not he believes that, you know, mitzvah or not. But he's doing this, like, nothing's compelling him, you know, to eat non-kosher. Nothing's compelling him to do something. It's a conscious decision he's making. Yeah.
Is there a distinction here between, let's say, the assumption by the Rambam that God, you know, knows what a person's thinking? So if a person does or thinks certain ways, that alone will cause him to, you know what I'm saying?
As yeah, so
instead, he, like, a person doesn't have to make a statement to a society of what he believes, but if he thinks that way anyway, even if he keeps quiet, he's crossed a
So that's actually something Rambam dealt with in an earlier halakha here, where he said about, you know, if you say that God doesn't know what people do. The problem with that is that, you know, what God knows and what we hold you accountable for are two different things. You know, but it's a tatashem itakum God's, you know, it's comes out ahead, but that was the wrong quote. You know, we say, like, on Yom Kippur, you know, or Rosh Hashanah, b'chein levavot v'yom din, like, God actually discerns you in the hearts and all that. There was another pasuk that just escaped me right now, but even so, you know, we're talking about how do we, as a Jewish society, you know, interact with people. God may know the difference, but we don't. And what God knows is up to God, right? How God wants to deal with it is up to God in terms of what would put you in this halacha category. If you do things privately, right, that you shouldn't be doing, like, yes, you might be considered, you know, a certain type of mumar, but we wouldn't know about it unless it was, you know, public. Unless you publicly made a statement as to what you believe, or until other people, like, really see what you're doing. That's why you have testimony, you go to court and all that sort of thing. Yeah.
What happens if you say you can't afford kosher meat?
Mm-hmm.
And so you shock me at the market and buy non-kosher meat.
Mm.
We'll see you do that. Well, you assume that you're doing this intentionally?
That's much, much bigger question, well beyond what we can do. It's a wonderful question, well beyond what we can answer now responsibly.
Okay.
That gets into a whole bunch of other things.
It's a key question.
I'm not saying it's a bad question.
That's the difference that when I left Israel and I came over here, we couldn't afford the kosher. Not to mention other things, and it was a big dilemma.
All right, so let's be dan l'chav here, okay? Let's try to be dan l'chav sechut. Reading the Lashon of the Rambam is, right, mumar ve'zeh shehechzik atzmo l'asot ota avera b'zadon v'urgal v'nitparsem ba, and this is something that you do it, you're sinning intentionally, and you have, and you're doing so, as they say, b'mezid, right? That's why I use the idiom of, the later idiom of mumar l'chachis. You're doing so intentionally. If you had another choice and you had the ability to buy kosher food, then yes. If you didn't, again, not saying this is a psak halacha, right? But I'm not making a psak halacha on what I would categorize, but according to the Lashon of the Rambam, it seems to be, to put in that category, you had to do so really out of spite as opposed to out of need. And again, the difference would be, if you could afford kosher food, then you would get kosher food. If you can't get kosher food, then you can't get kosher food. I mean, people will argue, well, maybe you should cut out this, cut out that, cut out that, or, all these cheshbonot would have to be done on a case-by-case basis. But someone who, someone who's like really at the poverty line, someone who is mitparnes from tzedakah, like someone who's, on the street asking for money, right, the extra 20 cents on getting something kosher versus not kosher is huge. And he said, I'd really love to keep up the kosher stuff, but, I just can't because I can't live like that. To me, at least based on the logic of the Rambam, wouldn't put you in that category of doing something, b'zadon mezid, and you're trying to, regulate yourself to doing an avera, b'shem avera, really sitting for the sake of sitting, you're trying to get by. It's more of a shat hadachak, like more of an emergency situation. Again, everything will be done on a case-by-case basis, but I think the Rambam, my read of the Rambam, at least, would be that there would be a distinction there. And note that he also takes it to, lehachis, when you're doing something intentionally, to even doing what's called a bitul aseh. Well, there are two types of ways you can say do something inappropriate. One is when you do something that the Torah says not to, and that's normally when we think of a sin as like, God says, don't murder, you murder, you just did a sin. Another type is a bitul aseh, which is God tells you to do something and you don't do it, where you have sort of violated a commandment through inaction. Right? Now, there are times when we will have what's called the shev v'al ta'aseh. Well, the sages will say, like in certain conflicts, it's better to, not sin actively, but rather not do something. But Rambam here is talking about a case where you intentionally decide not to keep a certain mitzvah. To throw out just one random one, for some reason you have a moral or ethical objection to lulav and etrog. I don't know. Maybe you think that, it's against this green earth type thing some way.
Cruelty to plants.
What? Cruelty to plants. There you go. So it's cruel to or it's, wasteful environment. You shouldn't be cutting them down. Rahata is, you're not going to shake lulav and etrog to make a point that you think this is wrong. Right? Okay. Yes. Have you sinned in the, what we would consider a classical definition? Or for whatever other reason, you just want to, be a jerk around saying, I'm not going to do lulav and etrog this year. Or tefillin. That would be another one. You hold a pita, cruelty to animals, because tefillin are made out of animals, right? You've got, the ritzuot, which are leather, the batim, also made of animal byproducts, the parchment and all that, saying, I'm not going to put on tefillin because I don't wear leather, right? Okay, we can see that a little bit more. So because of that, I'm not going to put on tefillin. That might put you under category of, a mumar lahafis, because,
Some people say it's cruel.
But shkita is a little
it's
bit... With shkita, it's a little bit different, because you could be vegetarian. Right? There's no... There's a chiluk among certain yeshivot between a mitzvah chiyuvit and a mitzvah kiyumit. There are certain things that you have an obligation to do, and other things, if you do X, then you have to do Y. For example, wearing tzitzit. is not an intrinsic mitzvah to put on the tzitzit. It's if you wear a four-cornered garment, that four-cornered garment needs tzitzit. If you don't wear tzitzit, you don't have. If you don't wear a four-cornered garment, you don't have the obligation of tzitzit. The Torah says when you divorce your wife, you have to write a get. Does that mean that you have a mitzvah to divorce your wife? Of course not. It means should you divorce your wife, you write a get. Shechita, same too. There's no obligation. We don't all here have an obligation to go and kill animals. If we want to eat kosher meat, then it has to be shechted in a certain way. But you can live a pretty good life without eating animals. People do this. Called vegetarians, right? So that's what I would make a difference. As opposed to, say, lulav and etrog, where you have to shake it, wearing tefillin, you have to put it on, right? That's different because that's something which you actually, you all have to do. Or like sitting in a sukkah is a good example. You have a mitzvah to sit in a sukkah, but you don't have a mitzvah to build one. Right? You know, and that's, you know, a huge thing, which is why, you know, there's a whole thing about being a hetzer mitzvah, right? Something building a sukkah enables you to do a mitzvah, but nor do you have to build one. You just have to sit in one when you eat. I'm like, okay, fine. Like, that's, you know, that's where you have an important distinction there, and why I use the example of tefillin and not shechita. There's actually a joke. I shouldn't say a joke. This I heard attributed to Yeshayahu Leibowitz, philosophy professor, around Purim time, that on Purim in Israel, Purim is celebrated on two different days. Outside of Yerushalayim, it's celebrated on the 14th of Adar, and in Yerushalayim, it's celebrated on the 15th. So what a bunch of yeshiva people do to keep two mitzvot of Purim is they rely on the opinion that says, you know, how, let's say you travel from one to the next, and it doesn't have to be so far. You're only talking about a 15-minute drive, you know, or, you know, to get out of the boundaries, or 20 minutes, depending on whatever. You know, it's a simple drive to do. They say, well, it's wherever you spend the night. So if you spend the night, you know, with the 14th outside of Yerushalayim, then you would keep Purim that day. And if you spend, you know, the night of the 15th in Yerushalayim, you keep Purim on the 15th. So if you spend the night of the 14th outside and the night of the 15th inside, you actually have to do two Purims. And you observe two Purims, which would mean you have to hear Megillah a total of four times. You would have two Se'udot. I mean, I don't know if people, like, really, you know, accept everything. You have to do two Se'udot, two sets of, you know, Mishloach Manot, Matanot Le'evyon, and the whole nine yards.
That's the spin.
Right. You know, you really have to go through. I mean, I think people do it because it gives them an excuse to get drunk for yet another day. It was told to me, I don't know if this is true or not, in the name of Yeshayahu Leibowitz, of doing it the other way. You spend the night of the 14th in Yerushalayim, and the night of the 15th outside of Yerushalayim, in which case it turns out that you were never obligated in Purim at all. The logic would have to work the other way too.
It's a legal way.
No.
Meaning in the legal way out of it, in which case you never had the obligation of Purim. Because when you were in Yerushalayim, it was Purim for everyone else but not for you. When you leave Yerushalayim, it's not Purim out there, but it is in there. Meaning if you want us, the point is, if you're going to rely on the assumption that this is how you define when you are obligated in which day of Purim, right? If it works one way to obligate you for 2 days, then the inverse would also have to hold true to be exempt you from both days.
Wait a minute, hang on.
Yeah.
All right. So, U.S. Jew visits Israel Pesach.
Different set of halachot.
Oh, but come on, it's not a similar thing?
Not in the least. Completely different set of halachot about Yom Tov Sheni. Completely different set there.
I ain't buying it.
It sounds strange, and I think the reason why I would attribute it to him is based on my knowledge of the readings. It would sound
maybe he was doing Purim Torah.
But it sounds like something he would do, though. Which, like, given his philosophy, if anyone would do it, it would be him. So even if he didn't do it, I could see how students of his might, you know, do this. Just to it's even if it's not, you know, consider a Purim Torah, it's one of these things where the obligate, you're putting yourself in a situation where you never had the obligation to begin with, which is very different than saying Purim is going on and I'm not fulfilling it. You're putting yourself in a situation where you never had to. To give another example, let's say you don't like saying Birkat HaMazon, right? You don't like benching for some, I don't know, crazy reason.
Yeah.
Just never eat bread. If you never eat bread, you never have to say Birkat HaMazon.
But then you're missing... What, you're missing...
Yeah, forget Shabbos.
Yes.
Forget Shabbos for a second, you know, and that whole thing. But my point is, to avoid saying Birkat HaMazon, you just don't put yourself in a place where you would have that obligation to do so. That's very different than eating bread and not benching. That would be another good distinction, a way of, you know, making, you know, trying to say what Rambam is saying in terms of a bitul aseh l'hach'is. When do you nullify a positive commandment out of spite? And in order for you to do that, you would have to have that commandment, that obligation, not necessarily put yourself in a situation where you wouldn't have to do it.
So bitul aseh l'hach'is would apply to the person who goes to Yerushalayim for the...
No, that would be... I wouldn't put that in that category, because then you're putting yourself in a situation where you never had the obligation. It's like someone who never...
You're doing it on purpose.
But it would be like if you never put on a four-cornered garment because you don't want to wear tzitzit. Right? You just don't put yourself in a situation where this mitzvah would apply. Now, you could say he's not, you know, he may be doing something else incorrectly and inappropriate. You can say it's bad in some way, like I'm not endorsing it. But I wouldn't... my read of Rambam, and again, this, I'm sure people would disagree, but my understanding of Rambam is that that wouldn't put you in the category of a mumar lahachis, of being a rebel, an intentional rebel, by not doing a positive commandment for the purposes of losing a lamb. I think that Rambam, my read of this halachan Rambam would be not like that. Yes, it sounds strange, but when you make the other analogies and you make the distinctions between, you know, the mitzvah chiyuvit, mitzvah kiyumit, when you have an obligation to do something versus in certain situations you have to do something, you don't put yourself in a certain situation, there's a very big difference there, right? Because in one case you're actually rebelling against what God tells you to do versus you just sort of exempt yourself from being in that parasha. You exempt yourself from having that obligation. And there are, I think there are, you know, there's a legal difference there. Yeah.
Could you 30 seconds to...
That happens to be, you know, a lot. But he, how to put it? It would take too long in his thought. I mean, to give like an example of something else you attributed to him, as reported to me, said that, you know, the Kotel is now a place of a Makom Avodah Zarah, that we've turned, you know, this wall into a shrine that people have actually worshipped. The reason why I say that, it's a certain, it's a bad term to use, but a more of modern contemporary view of like Judaism, you know, where things are like, you know, there's really no way I can do this very quickly. I mean, I can give you some good readings about it. You know, some things about his attitude that, you know, if he would, you know, but yeah, he did not, he was not, let's put it this way. He was not a fan of knee-jerk religious fanaticism. You know, and let's put it that way. So, you know, and he would make, and if anyone would make a point of being anti-fanatic, it would be someone who has taken stances. And if reading his writings, I'll put this out, you know, in terms of reading recommendations for Leibowitz. He has a book called Accepting the Yoke of Torah, which are his insights on Parshat HaShavuah. It's also Gan B'Ivrit. I forget which what it's called there, but it's, you know, his book on Parshat HaShavuah. Very short essays, like maybe 2 to 3 pages. And if you just, even if you don't do it parsha by parsha, you just read through it as a straight book, you'll see a lot of how his attitude is and his approach to Judaism. I don't know. I just know. But it's a very good book. It's a very readable book, and you'll see his approach to...
I just wanted to throw one more.
Sure.
I feel like he's in many ways in Misnagid, as opposed to the Hasidim.
Could be. It's
just in general, not old-fashioned Masorti, that the way Judaism evolved and Hasidism.
I'm not sure.
He may be more similar to them.
I'm not sure I would make that chiluk, because he...
What?
Why? Because there's a certain... There's a certain
traditional.
He is traditional, but he has a spirituality to him that, where the Mitnagdim might be considered super rationalistic.
Exactly. No, that's why I say it's similar.
He has he has enough of his his spirituality is very different than the Mitnagdim and the Hasidim.
No, I agree.
He also has a book called Religion State in Israel, I don't know what it's in Hebrew, but Religion, State, and Israel, which is more of a political-minded book. That's also excellent. But
I'm sure this could go on for hours.
Yeah.
A quick question.
Yeah.
And if there had been Hasidim in the Rambam's time, would he have been... What would he have done?
Yeah, that's much longer. I'll tell you what. We'll get there. Hopefully when we get to... If I can actually get sources and translate it well, we can do Hasidim versus Mitnagdim or Vilna Gaon versus the Hasidim. That can be a lot of fun in terms of what were his issues. And, I'd rather not read into it because I can't read Rambam's mind. But at any rate, that's at least...
What would he say in the spectrum between Leibovitz and Hasidim?
Lo Navi Ano. You know what? Halavai, we all live for Tchiyat HaMetim. I would pay to just hear conversations between these people and just to see how it would go.
So as far as you and Rambam,
thank you. All right, so let's move on to the second part here about the Mumar L'chol HaTorah Kula. The example he gives here is for Avodah Zarah. Now, this is a facet. It's not just Avodah Zarah, but note exactly how he describes Avodah Zarah. And Dan got, I think, this point, I think, hit the nail on the head. When normally, there's certain things that if you do certain averot, it's considered that you violated kol haTorah kula. One of them is avodah zarah, right? Another one is mechalel Shabbat b'farhesia. You violate Shabbat in public. Although I believe the Chazon Ish, backtracked on that today. He said because when people do it in public, it has a very different social significance. That when you only lived in a Jewish neighborhood, if you violated Shabbat in public, you were really, it's kind of like being a mumar l'davar achad. But certain things are big enough that it's like all of Torah, or equated with all of Torah, and Shabbat is one of them. It would be like, going in the middle of, Hasidic Brooklyn, driving your car, through it, blaring the radio, ha ha ha, I'm not keeping Shabbos type thing. That would be more of the thing of I'm doing this, out of spite, whereas for most other communities where it's not all Jews, it would be very different today. So, and you also have a Tinok Shenishpah issue of you're not really doing it intentionally, just this is how you were raised. But he's talking here about Avodah Zarah. Avodah Zarah is one of the things that's equated to the entire Torah. Now, I asked at the very beginning, if you're a Mumar for one, why would you give something separate to Avodah Zarah? And Rambam here gives the answer. Meaning, if you decided to, go into another religion because you were convinced by it, saying, I'm going to reject Judaism ideologically, well, that certainly would have put you in terms of a whole bunch of other categories. This seems to be, in a weird way, umumar l'te'avon, but for Avodah Zarah. You're going to Avodah Zarah not because you're rebelling against God, not because you necessarily think this is a better way of worshiping and you're making a theological error, which might have put you in a previous category. You're doing so out of personal expediency, right? You're saying, right, you had, it said, a b'sha'ash gozerin gezerah. This is a time when the scenario that Rambam is putting this in is you're living in a time where the government said you can't be Jewish anymore. Or rather, you're forced to convert to, let's say, to pick something that's value neutral, Pastafarianism. If anyone doesn't know what that is, there was a satirical religion invented in the past couple of years where someone was, opposed to teaching creationism in school because, it's a theory. So he said, well, I can just come up with a theory that the world was created by a flying spaghetti monster. The flying spaghetti monster, FSM, and they call it Pastafarianism. So it's Pastafarianism. And there's actually you can find pictures on the internet of, this giant flying spaghetti thing with meatballs for eyes. And it was set up as a counter joke to creationists. Well, if creationism is science, well, saying the flying spaghetti monster created the world is just as scientific. So I'm picking that because it's value neutral. So if someone says, you have to worship the flying spaghetti monster, and you can say as a Jew, well, yes, in the time of the Gzerah, you shouldn't do it, but, you can say, well, I'm going to stick with them. Why? Because, why should I be Jewish? Right? I'm being oppressed, right? So why should I live being oppressed when I'll just, sign on with these guys, right? I'm going to side with the winning team. right? Not because it's, you know, great. Not even necessarily because of fear, right? Because if someone forces you, it's one of the Avodah Zarah is one of the Yehareg V'al Ya'avor. We saw this in some of our earlier classes. If someone puts a gun to your head and say, you know, bow down to this idol and pray to this idol, otherwise I kill you, you're supposed to let yourself be killed rather than bow down. If you do so under coercion, we still don't hold you accountable in the same level as if you did so willingly. This is a case when you do so willingly simply because you don't want to be hassled, right? There's a very big difference between, say, being a Marana, which we call, you know, the Anusim, right? And versus saying, hey, I'm just going to go along with the Inquisition because, yeah, who needs this Jewish religion, right? There are different subtleties here, which is why I think it's important that he makes this distinction. You're signing on with Avodah Zarah, whatever Avodah Zarah is. We're actually going to talk about it a little bit more in the Tuesday class, shameless plug. We're going to be discussing some encounters with Avodah Zarah based on a lot of discussions we've been having in Shul. Yes, shameless plug. But it's because there's a certain ta'ava. You're not doing so for ideological reasons. You're not even doing so because you're forced to. You're doing it because it's simply easier. Yeah.
And that's something like...
You choose to do it.
I go to church services every Sunday because the music is wonderful and I love to watch the pageantry.
So that's different. That I would even say, we'll do that, we'll discuss that a little bit more in detail on Tuesday in our Beit Midrash session. This isn't that. This isn't like, you know, you're coming to it. This is you're actually worshiping. You're sticking with it, right? He uses the words, you know, Mambetza li dabek Israel. Why, you know, what were the, you know, he uses that word also, which goes, li dabek bahem. Right, you're not just showing up every now and again. You're cleaving to them, and it says, "Why should I stick?" Literally, like the word "devek" means, you know, it's glue. Why am I sticking with the Jewish people? You're actually changing teams here, right? It's not like you're doing something or another. You're saying, you know, forget this Judaism. This is too hard for me. These other guys have it much better. Right, so I'm going to give this up, not again, not for ideological reasons, not because, you know, I'm doing it to save my life, right? You're doing so because it's easier. And because even in the first case, where it says l'hach'is, or, you know, or not, I mean, I keep using that idiom, but he'chzik atzmo la'asot etav erab zadon, where you're doing, like, even not wearing shatnez to rebel against God, here you're not doing avodah zarah to rebel against God. That would be obvious, right? But if you do something like avodah Zarah out of convenience that would otherwise be considered l'te'avon, right? And if you would make the analogy for any other sin, for Avodah Zarah, it is so chamur, it is that strict, that's considered as if you rebelled against the entire Torah. Interesting, huh? Mm. I mean, if you, you know, decide to go by, you know, another team here. Yeah. Issue? If you want, I can pause if you want to.
Can you repeat the last
thing? You know, so again, you know, on a level of pshat, in the first, you know, for the first category, it seemed to be you are violating a mitzvah, you know, out of lahachis when you're doing so to rebel as a mumar, you know, against God because you don't like mitzvah. You say, I'm not doing this, you know, lishma, you know, lahachis. In the second half, when he gives an example of a mumar l'cholat Torah kula, and gives the example of Avodah Zarah, his example isn't you're being, you're worshipping Avodah Zarah, right, as rebelling against God in, you know, in the same way, but you're rebelling against God by worshipping Avodah Zarah because it's easier for you. Mm-hmm. Meaning it's not because you think that this God is a better God than your God. You're not doing so because, you know, you have a period where they're going to kill you. You're doing so because it's easier. You're saying, well, I don't need Judaism. They have it better. I'm going to go over there. So it seems to be a little bit more like a te'avon, but mumar le'te'avon la'avodah zarah is considered mumar l'chol ha'Torah kula. Mm-hmm. Actually, pause it for a second. I mean, for another example here. Okay, now the recorder's back on. So yeah, you guys don't know what you missed. You know, you can. You know, you can look at today about, you know, distinction of what does it mean. Well, actually, we'll get it to in source number 6 in our listing 311. You know, about if someone says that, you know, you're going against certain norms in public, like, oh, you know, that's, you know, already too much for us. That, you know, I think the fact that when you do something the regularity of it, and like really would put you under, you know, a very different category. Do we have time for source number five here? I don't think so, and I actually want to include another source for number five because we won't be able to do it in its own shear, and we'll have to throw that in. So let's hold off on source number five. Does anyone else have more questions on, you know, source number four, this distinction between the mumar lahachis, mumar l'teavon, someone who rebels intentionally, someone who rebels out of a desire, and the special role of Avodah Zarah? No, three at a time here.
It's a shatness.
Yeah.
Is shatness the arisal?
Yeah.
So why is it considered light?
It's considered light because it's an easy mitzvah to do, or at least meaning to not wear linen and wool together is pretty easy. Right?
Then, perhaps.
Even now.
Because
you have shatnez checkers.
Shoes were made by shoemakers, clothes were made by, virtually by hand, so you knew what was in it. Now you go to the department store, you don't know what's in it.
Well, you've got labels. I mean, look, save my shirts. Right, I think I've got like maybe 1 or 2 100% cotton. Most of them are, you know, cotton polyester. That's what most shirts are made out of. Right. The thing is to wear also don't forget, like, wearing linen and wool is a prohibition. To wear linen and wool, think about it back then. The reason why it considers it a lighter one, not to say that it's anywhere less severe, but it's so much easier to not do it. Right, because when you've got so many other options of clothing, right, when you put, and even using your own example, yeah, you know, assuming you're living in a time where you know you made your own clothes, you know what went into it.
I can tell a tailor not to.
You could tell a tailor, or if you were making your own clothing, think about this, if you were responsible for making your own clothing, for you to put on shatnez, it would require specific effort, specific kavanah, intention, that this is what your clothing is going to be out of.
Can you remind me why I forgot?
No, just Torah says so.
Oh, we don't know why?
Well, I tend to avoid ta'ameh mitzvot.
No, remember, I thought I knew.
I avoid ta'ameh mitzvot, like, you know, for reasons like this. People will give various reasons for it, but, you know, I don't like giving those, because if I give a reason, someone says, oh, but that doesn't make sense, and someone else gives a reason for those. So for me, it's
so
just... HaKadosh Baruch Hu Omer, you know, goes there, and we're Mekayin. Like, that is ultimately lit. Mitzvah and Torah. Let's leave it at that. There are other prohibitions of various forms of kilayim, of certain things that we're not supposed to mix together, like in... Right, so it considers like big day kilayim. I mean, you might consider it analogous to like why we don't crossbreed certain fruits, why we don't crossbreed animals. So beyond this, can't really get into. Ira, then Dana. Yeah, you had something, then Dana.
No, I was just thinking that... I think for some people, I remember like Jimmy Carter was saying, I've sinned in my mind, you know, and all that. There must be something where someone has the intention or it's open to him to do something, but he's never had the opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder where that...
To quote the song, I'm not a coward, I've just never been tested. Mighty, mighty Boss Tones, if anyone listens. So there is a case where that comes up of...
Because it's kind of a little bit, it seems to me, like the one where you're saying someone will maybe change sides because it's just he doesn't want to have a problem or whatever.
Hirurei Avera, like having thoughts of sinning, takes on a weird role on its own, unaccompanied by action, doesn't seem to be a problem. And... one of the bases that I have for
what
this...
I kind of mean is that probably a person in his mind, if he thinks about a certain action, has accepted the action already, you know?
But unless he's done it,
but
right?
This is the difference probably between Judaism and a lot of Christianity, right?
Not being an expert in Christian theology, I'm not going to comment on that side about, you know, sinning with the mind. But I know for halakha... you know, you would actually need to have it accompanied. I mean, you are right that there are certain things where kavanah is important, your intention is important, but if all you have is a bad intention but you don't act on it at all, you're not going to get punished just for having, you know, you can't necessarily control your thoughts. You know, cognitive behavioral therapists will tell you this all the time. You can't control what thoughts pop into your head. What you can control is how do you respond to them. Right? So we're more concerned with how you respond to them than just, you know, oh, you had a bad thought. It just, you know, how do you react to that? Right? If just because a bad thought popped into your head, certainly, you know, Beit Din is not going to punish you for it. Is God going to punish you for it? I'm not God. I'm going to assume not, but I could be wrong. God does what God's going to do. Dana.
Okay, so this is a double whammy. Now in Mishpatim, they differentiate between the thief and the robber, and they differentiate in the punishments because if you're more afraid of what people think than what God thinks...
Yes.
Right. So similarly, if you're Mechal Shabbos Befarhesia, right, you're kind of saying, I don't care what people think, and therefore... I guess why is it a greater punishment?
That's a great distinction.
You're in your face with people.
Okay, let me explain the difference here. In halacha, there are two types of halacha categories for theft. You know, in civil law, you've got theft and grand larceny, which is dependent on how much you steal. For other things in civil law, you've got murder and manslaughter, right? You know, even though you're doing the same act of killing someone, you know, there are different... There are enough nuances between the laws to have, you know, this is this application, you've got different punishments. So with theft, there are two types of thieves in Jewish law, a ganav and a gazlan. I mean, we're more familiar with the term ganav being is like, oh, you're a ganav, you're a thief. And here's how it works. A ganav would be like a cat burglar, someone who breaks into your house in the dead of night and walks away with stuff. And a gazlan is a mugger. And the difference is, in the former, right, you're trying to sneak in under the dead of night, you know, making sure no one sees you. And a mugger is confrontational, in your face about it, like, you know that I'm robbing you because I have a gun to your head, right? And because there's so much more brashness and so much more audacity, right? It's, you know, there are different rules behind it. What are the rules? If you're a gazlan, you pay whatever you stole. If you're a ganav, you pay kefel. You pay double the amount. That second part, that double the amount, is a knas.
Don't you have a gun?
No. And let me explain why. That's the whole point. The reason being, the sages put that kefel, that double amount, the first amount that you stole, you pay back. Like, that's regular. But if you're a ganav, if you're sneaking in the dead of night, Chazal put on a knas, they fine you an additional 100% of whatever it is that you stole. Why? Because you were more afraid of man than God. Meaning, if I'm mugging Ed over here, I'm not afraid of him. Right? But if I'm sneaking into his apartment at night, it shows that I am afraid of him because I don't want to get caught. Right? So because you demonstrated greater fear of man than God, the sages fine you whatever you stole. But it's important that that was a fine that the rabbinic sages set up. Now what you're asking here is, well, why wouldn't they say, well, couldn't that brashness also apply to other issues like being Mechal al Shabbat? And here's what I would make a difference, a differentiation. When you do a theft, you're talking about a certain type of financial penalty. But with gazlanut, well, that's so the ikaradin, you pay back whatever you stole. But when Chazal say we're going to attach an additional fine to it, right? It's like in America, you know, if I injure someone, you've got the damages that I caused, and then they can put on punitive damages, which is like, here's how much you caused, like you owe him. Like if I damaged, you know, George's car somehow or whatever, George had a plot of land, and I did something on it, and it cost George like $50 to clean up, that's $50 that I owe of direct damage. But the court can also say, because you were a jerk about it, because you were responsible, I'm going to put like $20 million punitive damages on you. And then you appeal later courts, and then, you know, they wind up knocking it down until pretty much nothing. But courts do that. It's a punitive damage that a court has the authority to impose on people. Right? And they imposed it so you can ask, like, why did they not decide to impose it for gazlan? You could think theologically it's worse. This is where they decided to put on...
Well, in a way, it leads to encouraging violence because it's almost a land. So it's better to... confront somebody with a gun, then
not. Not necessarily. The exact opposite. The exact opposite. Because if I draw a gun on you, if I draw a knife on you, and you know how to defend yourself, right?
It gives me a chance.
Not only does it give you a chance, but if I know who's robbing me, right, you can get back at the guy, right? There's a huge, huge difference there. I mean, you have cases about, you know, you can read stories about people who ward off muggers. you know, with whatever, you know, it's not, it's a lot, although I can't necessarily say that it's safer. There is a halakha called Baba Machteret, that if, you know, there's an intruder in your house and it's dark and you know that there's an intruder, you know, you don't know who it is, you know, light's not up, halakha is you can shoot first and ask questions later, and you're not held liable for it. Once you know, like, the person is a separate halakha. So in some cases it might not be safer, but you still run less of a risk of waking up the guy and assuming he has a shotgun. Whereas, you know, if I meet someone on the street, I don't know if they're, you know, packing, you know, I don't know if they've got a gun. If I'm trying to mug someone with a knife, I don't know what else they have. I don't know if they know how to defend themselves. You can
taking a bigger chance.
Exactly. You're taking a chance. Not you're taking a chance of defense, and you're taking a chance of. Look, if someone breaks into my house, I don't know who did it, right? So police have to come, dust for fingerprints. Truth is, now they may not even care because they're so overworked.
It'd be more dangerous because
but if I'm mugged, I go to the cops, I give them a description. Here's what he looked like. Here's what he was wearing. You know, here's the stuff that he had with him. So it's a much greater probability for him to get caught. Yeah.
But logically, I think someone hearing this would assume that the person who mugs someone confrontationally is willing to step over the lines of violence if the person resists.
Yeah, I mean,
but
maybe
you might not have that with someone breaking into
or whatever. The point is that this is how Chazal set up the halacha. Now, getting back to Dana's question, like, what about Bavima Halal Shabbat Befarhesia, right? You're breaking Shabbat in public. You know, in terms of severity, is a certain way of saying. It's not saying that I'm more afraid of, you know, God than I am of you, because you're not doing a crime against other people. What you're doing is you're making a public demonstration. And again, think back into the days where you lived in, you know, not just, you know, a ghetto, but like your own Jewish neighborhood. You are making a public statement that I am no longer part of this community. And that the main, one of the main, you know, things about Shabbat and how we live a week, you publicly make a demonstration. I'm being Mechalal Shabbat, showing everyone else that you are Mechalal Shabbat, is a way of removing yourself from the Kehillah. Like, I can mug you in a back alley, right? So yeah, you know, I'm more afraid of, you know, I'm not afraid of you or God, but it's very different than, say, mugging an individual in a back alley, which, even though it's in front of another person, is very different than doing so berabim. When you do a certain averot berabim in public, right, then you're making more of that public declaration that we were talking about in the previous halachot, you know, that would intentionally remove yourself from the Jewish community by, you know, by saying, I'm not one of you. Right? So that would be the distinction that I would make there.
Cool.
Yeah. Any other questions? Alrighty, so we're going to continue next week with number 5. We'll talk a little bit more about Tzaddik and Baitas that we mentioned a bit, and the thing that I want to add to the source sheet is actually something that Rambam says elsewhere. For anyone else who's interested, the Tuesday night shiur is on Encounters with Avodah Zarah, which is, given that we live, we're Jewish, but we don't live in a Jewish world. We're confronted with various idolatries. What are some of, it's not going to be comprehensive. The truth is, I could do a whole sheer topic, whole, you know, graduate lecture just on that alone. We're going to do selective sources about engaging and encountering Avodah Zarah with contemporary examples. Things like artwork, you know, entering churches like that, music and stuff. And yeah, we'll be doing some fun things from, some classical and some contemporary responsa. So that'll be Tuesday night at 7:30.
Cool. See you
later. Yeah, cool. Great.